Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined today again by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. Welcome to the full-on holiday season.
If I'm feeling it, you know, all the lights are out. The offices are decorated. The kids are about to leave.
Yeah, campus. You know, if you haven't been to the South Mall at UT recently.
Oh, yeah, the South Mall. It's gorgeous.
Because we were working the night shift last night doing our review session.
Yeah.
You know, some people may feel troubled by some of the things going on at the university.
Oh, yeah.
But one of the things we do have is a really spectacular light show mounted on the oak trees on the South Mall. Very Instagrammable. There's also
Very Instagrammable, yeah.
It just says Texas or
is it Texas?
There's an Instagram spot. Makes you feel good about higher education again.
We do some things right here.
You know, we decorated that bad boy to the hilt.
It's great. It's even the lights change. There's like almost like a little thing, you know. Trail lights, no need.
So if you're in North Central Austin, maybe you're on your way to 37th Street.
And
if they're
nighttime.
Still doing that and it's nighttime.
Yeah.
You know, add the UT South Mall to your light trip.
Recommend.
To your light trip. All right, I'm not going to comment any further on light trip. So what do we got going today? There's, you know, something of a calm before the storm dynamic to this week's political environment, particularly in Texas. I mean, I think it's just continuing to be stormy at the national level. But,
right.
You know, we're waiting for the Supreme Court ruling on the congressional maps, which, you know, I was talking to, you know, did this panel, as you know, Josh, for PAP, Professional Advocacy Association of Texas, yesterday with Harvey Kronberg and Brad Johnson and our friend Gromer, they're all our friends, but Gromer Jeffords Jr. And, you know, Brad and I were talking about, you know, Brad kind of mentioned, you know, you think they're going to rule on those maps kind of soon, given that there's this other thing hanging out there, which is the filing deadline for the March primary elections, which is Monday the 8th.
Yeah, something's got to give at some point.
We record here on Thursday morning.
Right.
So you would think one might have some urgency there. But, you know, I mean, if you want to be, we're kind of getting into it. Well, I'll just put a pin on that. But, you know, the suspicious type might think that the delay might be baked in. So anyway, given that looming over here at the state level, kind of chaotic national politics, I started to sort of mention a few things and there's just too many things.
Yeah, there's a lot.
So, you know, some of that'll come up. I thought we'd start today with a look at some of the highlights of a just-released Politico national poll that came out this morning as some broader context, you know, and touches on some things that we've seen in statewide polling. We can talk about that a little bit. Then zoom in a little bit back on a couple of big stories in Texas political news this week that do speak and intersect with this moment that we're talking about, this calm before the storm. Calm before the storm is exactly right. It's just kind of
waiting.
You know, dweller on the threshold, as Van Morrison would say. So the first is, you know, Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett has scheduled a press conference for Monday afternoon after several weeks, if not months, of speculation about whether she was going to get in the U.S. Senate race. She set up, you know, again, an armada of trial balloons on this. So, you know, we'll take a little look at her numbers and kind of feel that out a little bit. And then second, President Trump on Wednesday, yesterday as we're recording, pardoned Congressman Henry Cuellar and his wife for any crimes that were related to this indictment that he's under for bribery. And he announced that. I don't think I've seen the actual document of the pardon, but
yeah, it was posted on Truth Social.
Yes, it was on Truth Social. And so, but widely accepted. And he's spoken to this that, you know, that's going to happen. Obviously, a big development for you know, a race that's getting some, you know, a bit of attention in Texas and even nationally. Lots of implications there. So, you know, both of these stories, big implications for 2026, but also, you know, help invite some discussion of the broader factors at play. You know, if you want to be a little wonky about it in the parties, in the party system in the state, et cetera. So
I do.
yeah. Yes. A slow pitch there. I don't know. I don't know enough about soccer to know what the more appropriate soccer metaphor is. Soft pass.
Yeah, that's called a hospital ball, actually. So you don't want a soft pass.
I'm writing that down. Hospital ball.
Yeah, you don't want a soft pass.
Okay. So, you know, assessing this broader context of the elections is one of the reasons we'll start. I thought we'd start with this Politico poll. So, you know, they pushed the top line. What did you make of this? Give us a little bit of the bullet, Josh, and then we can talk about it some.
So first, you know, I mean, like, obviously from where we're sitting, you know, we see this as sort of a pretty clear reflection of some of the stuff we're seeing in Texas, which is what they were leading with was, you know, concerns over cost of living and the fact that, you know, a little more than half of voters express, you know, a significant concern about the cost of living. In particular, this concern is across the parties. Now, they don't exactly, from what we can tell, provide us with party detail, but they tell us based on who people are intending to vote for in the upcoming congressional elections and stuff is one way to look at it. But the point is whether nationally these voters intend to vote for Democrats, intend to vote for Republicans, intend to vote for independents, almost 60% across the board say cost of living is too high. Now, the big piece that they then pushed was sort of on top of that, the notion that, you know, in terms of this affordability crisis, more Americans are increasingly tying that to President Trump.
Right.
And what they really pushed was, you know, the share of Republicans or Trump supporters who also hang the blame on him for the economy, and in particular, the cost of living here. And so that's sort of the thing that kind of was their lead. And they really were saying, you know, 37% of essentially Trump voters said, you know, the cost of living here is worse that they can ever remember. And that was kind of their pushing point.
That worse, I thought that worse than I can ever remember was a little bit of a...
We
can do that for a little bit. Yeah. I didn't love the question. It's not...
No.
It's not wrong or, you know, there's some estimation going on there, but it's kind of a weird question.
What it's probably trying to do is it's trying to avoid... I mean, this is the challenge. Like, whenever you're trying to ask people to do something with time... The time frame can be really important, and it can.
Yeah, our colleague Darren is very attentive to this, I think.
And you know, it can sometimes clarify things. Sometimes, you know, necessarily, and sometimes it can confuse things. You know, both in terms of, you know, the respondent, but also in terms of interpretation. And then in the worst cases, and I'm not saying anybody's doing this here at all, actually, it can, you know, I would say bias things, right? Because the idea is like, well, compared to what? Well, if I say compared to this generally peaceful, happy, prosperous, compared to, you know, the mid-90s, you might say, well, what about, you know, after the 2008 financial crisis?
Yeah.
So the point of reference kind of matters. And to your point, I think, you know, when you say, well, what about, you know, in your entire lifetime? Well, you know, I mean, ultimately what that ends up being is a challenge because every respondent has a different...
It seems almost like you have to lead with the age breakdowns, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. It invites it for sure.
Right.
And so it's not a great question, but I think what I would say is more than anything, you can sort of take with a grain of salt the exact number. And what I would do is look at that and say, no, but what you're seeing here is that you're seeing about a third of otherwise, you know, as far as we can tell, identifiable Trump supporters. I say about a third, maybe it's probably maybe a little more, maybe a little less, you know, identify the cost as a significant problem. And this is really the important part, they associate, you know, sort of this under his watch.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's his fault or not, it's under his watch.
And they do a good job, I think, a reasonable job of balancing, you know, we've had to do this a lot, you know, that, you know, these concerns are there.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's easy to forget. I can't remember if we talked about this. You and I had this in conversation. Yeah. I can't remember if it was recorded or not, but it's easy to forget that we're still not through the first entire year of this term, right? So, I mean, the fact that, you know, one can make it, one should not be surprised that as we near the end of year one, that even Trump supporters are beginning to kind of say, well, you know,
and even
this administration, you know, to the extent we're going to hold administrations responsible for this, and, you know, somebody kind of, you know, nipped at me a little bit yesterday on the panel about, you know, the magical properties, you know, attributed to presidents in terms of the economy, which
yeah.
fair enough. But, you know, I mean, at this point, I mean, we should be expecting people, if they're going to have that that sense that the president yeah. should be responsible, to start saying, yeah, you know, why are you still talking about Joe Biden? I like you. You're great. But, you know, you're the guy now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, an easier thing to sort of just take a step back and say, you know, governing is hard. And even set aside Trump, set aside yeah. everything else, you know, we should expect to see some amount of decay in terms of,
right.
you know, the support for the ruling party, even among their own supporters. But I think what's interesting about the way that, you know, Politico ran this in some ways, and I think what's going to turn a bunch of people off from it immediately is like, oh, so you're saying a small minority of Trump voters have a problem with the economy?
Well, that's what, you know, that's what I was going to get at is, you know, they're having to balance this thing where, you know, you can see this movement because of this
right.
natural phenomenon, but it's, you know, this is not a sign of collapse, but, you know, again, signs of erosion. And so they, you know, they do what they can with that. You know, I
yeah.
mean, you know, 3/4 of Trump voters say they trust the Republican Party more than Democrats
right.
to reduce the overall cost of living. No big surprise, but that, you know, his numbers are weaker in that count among those who identify as MAGA than, I mean, among non-MAGA aligned
right.
voters compared to MAGA. So,
well, I think,
you know, 88% of people who,
right.
you know, respond that they identify with MAGA in the poll, you know, still trust him more. The gap between but the non-MAGA gap is something 61%.
Yeah. No, and I think the
that's,
thing,
you know, not nothing, 27 point gap, but, you know.
Well, I think the challenge for, you know, let's say Republican voters who want to, you know, take a poll like this and sort of, you know, discount it in some way or say, oh, yeah, but like, you know, what about what you're saying? You know, if we look at where is the support, how overwhelming is the support amongst
yeah.
the key groups? And you say, yeah, that's right. But this is where I think the focus, you know, and again, I think, you know, it's a tough thing for, I think, a news organization, for a pollster, for anyone who's trying to do this in a sophisticated way to do it
yeah.
with a headline, right? But when I look at this, I mean, I think the thing you say is, yeah, you know, on the one hand, you can discount the share of, you know, Republicans and sort of Trump supporters who are, you know, seeing some warning signs
yeah.
because of the large share of them who don't. But the flip side of it is to remind people, and we have this conversation all the time, is how close elections are in this country.
Yeah.
Right. And the fact that, you know, for the most part, the elections that we've been seeing the last number of years are really about mobilization. And when you sort of have a party that, you know, where a quarter or a third are just really not into what's going on, you get like kind of how the Democrats saw in the last election cycle. Right. You see something like that where you say, oh, wow, the Democrats aren't hitting their numbers in the cities. Why is that? Well, because they were pretty unenthused, or large minorities of them were disenthused about, you know, what was going on. And that's what you see when you look at something like this. It really is like, this is not like a, oh my God, the bottom's falling out. But it's like, yeah, but, you know, if even among these uncommitted, lesser committed Republicans, maybe, let's just say,
yeah,
some number of them are like, yeah, you know, I don't know if this midterm is for me. I'm not going to vote for Democrats. And that's a good point here to make. But, you know, I'm not sure that I'm like full-throated, you know, coming out for whoever this congressperson is or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think the bigger thing, you know, when you say, what do I take away from this, you know, on that question of who holds responsibility, among the undecided voters in the poll, 74%, so nearly 3/4, said that the responsibility either mainly rests with Donald Trump, 20%, or fully rests with Donald Trump on the economy, which was 54%. That's the problem for Republicans. If I was going to,
right.
what are the flashing red lights in this poll? If you're Republicans looking at, you know, the national environment right now, that's the thing I'm worried about.
Yeah, I think that is a good number to focus on. I mean, I, and as we talk about this, not collapse but erosion, and what direction mm-hmm. is this going?
And is it above what we expect normally? Is
right.
it, you know, how
I mean,
this compare?
You know, this kind of, you know, was sort of hovering over this panel yesterday to some mm-hmm. degree. And I think it's, you know, kind of hovered over our discussions of this is
mm-hmm.
that, you know, this is partially a pivot, you know, back to Texas
yeah.
is that, you know, as we've seen in our numbers, you know, it's been a bad year for Republican incumbents.
Yeah.
Right. And not in a collapsey sort of way necessarily. But, you know, we were looking at this trend data that we have.
Mm-hmm.
People can find on our website at texaspolitics.utexasedu, in which, you know, there's no way to not look at
mm-hmm.
Republican incumbents' views and views of the economy and not see, particularly, though, the views of incumbents, a pretty clear slope in the wrong direction.
Yeah, throughout the course of this entire year that you're talking about.
Right. But it is this year.
Right.
Right. And so we'll go through the holidays.
People seem to chill out during the holidays a little.
We'll kind of move into election mode. The more public phase of the mm-hmm. election will begin to build.
Right.
And we don't know then how these two opposing, this is crude, but the two opposing forces, on one hand, people's lived interpretation, I'm not going to say experience because there's a lot of interpretation going on, but, their experiential kind of, their processing of their experience of the economy, which is just bad.
Yeah.
And partisan cues and, the effect of, campaign effects to some degree and the queuing that we're going to see from that. Now, that 2026 is going to be about that. And we do know that, what happens in the election year, the closer you get to the election is going to matter more than what we see right now.
Yeah.
And we don't know whether those trends are going to continue or not. And one can speculate on that, but
And I think that's leads us.
I don't think we can really say.
No. And that leads us kind of to right where we are now, which is that this is all being based on speculation. But what I think a lot of people are turning to, and it's sort of convenient, which is with the candidate filing deadline, one of the things that we kind of get a final picture on is, so where are the incumbents on all this?
Right.
And I always I love this, and I've said this on this podcast before, but if you want to get a sense of what, the real political experts, I'm making quote fingers right now, but the real political experts being the people who actually practice politics for a living, the people who are out there running for office, talking to voters, converting ideas into votes, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Horse
well,
trading.
And, relating their read of this environment to their own self-interest.
Well, and that's right. And that's the key here. I mean, I was talking to a reporter. I may have been writing with her. I don't remember. But I was talking to some reporter, and they were asking about, basically the herky-jerky around these lines. And, is this going to be confusing for voters? And I said, no, because voters right now are not paying attention to, whether this line is shifting over their house or not. They're, doing whatever. They're buying holiday stuff.
In terms of redistricting.
Yeah, in terms of redistricting. And the thing that we know about the elected officials is that whatever map gets adopted, they will do whatever they think is in their self-interest to get reelected, or if they don't think
and
they
one can interpret
won't.
That self-interest in kind of different, people have different priorities, right?
Yeah, people have different priorities at different points in their lives, obviously. Yeah. But the thing is, we're looking at this point. At this point, we can start to look at some of the trends, which people are doing now. They're looking at retirement numbers. They're looking at these different things. We are too.
And I meant not even just different parts of their lives. I mean, I think.
Oh yeah.
It's also their sensitivity to how hard they have to work.
Yeah, and I think
and risk their risk. And sensitivity.
And before we get into sort of the filing deadlines and some of the big news there, I'd say, looking at the retirement stuff just as a sort of, again, we got a little bit of time to let this, very little bit of time before this fully sorts out. But what does it look like right now? We've seen a number of Republican retirements from Congress.
Right. I was just thinking we could have added the Troy Nehls retirement.
Yeah. And so I think
decision we've, not to run for reelection to this news thing.
So I think we've six Republicans incumbents not running for re-election.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Right now, no Democrats have said they're not running for re-election. I believe in the congressional delegation. Except, well, it depends on the maps, right? I mean, Doggett could get
that's
moved out. It's a little bit confusing, right?
Yeah. Hence the pregnancy of this moment.
But what's notable is that it's interesting to say, okay, so Republicans are on the precipice of redistricting the congressional map in their advantage, and you've got six Republican incumbents saying, I'm not going to run again,
right?
Which, again, interesting. Now, the flip side is, you could say, is that a clear signal? Well, no, because you look at the state house and you look at that, you're seeing many fewer retirements. And
but as you were pointing out, but the map's different.
Well, that's exactly right.
The maps are better for state reps, but they're also, there's also not inconsequential number of state reps also deciding to hang it up.
Well, and a lot of them are not hanging it up is the interesting part. A lot of them are trying to move somewhere else. And that's, I think, what's interesting. One, the state house maps are safer. They were drawn in a way to be safer to begin with. So it's not surprising to see less movement. The other interesting thing to this whole, reading the tea leaves is, on the one hand, and we'll get to this in one second, you seem to have a lot of Democrats interested in running, for U.S. Senate in Texas. But also you do see, again, a lot of Republicans are looking to move right now. And they're looking to move into new positions. They're looking to move up. So if you're looking at the state level, not the federal races, I mean, you see more Republicans kind of on the march trying to capture these offices right now than you hear Democrats, who seem to be really focused on the Senate race by and large. I mean, there's a little bit of focus on some of the other races, but not anywhere nearly as much attention.
Right. No, I think that makes
sense.
And
I'd say just to put it all together, to say it doesn't really paint a totally clear picture of even how the experts are viewing this right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, when you look at I think you're really onto something in terms of the different incentives that are being perceived by incumbents and potential candidates between the two levels of the maps, right? So let's start with Jasmine Crockett.
Right.
Currently, you know, a member of Congress, has not been there that long. You know, people still remember her in the Texas legislature.
Meteoric rise.
I think fairly vividly would be a fair thing to say.
Yes.
Now, you know, the dominant kind of conventional trope out there, you know, she's got a pretty good shot at, you know, getting the Senate nomination given her favorability ratings and her name recognition compared to other major candidates in the race. State Rep James Tallarico, former Congressman Colin Allred, also the 2024 Senate candidate who lost that race. There was somebody on the panel yesterday, and I can't, you know, I'm not trying to, be diplomatic. I just can't remember who it was. But, you know, as we were discussing this on the panel, somebody called her now, if she got in, she would be a prohibitive favorite. And I didn't agree with that. And
that's
people
funny.
Kind of shrugged. But I do not think she's a prohibitive favorite.
No, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, I think the first thing that comes to my mind is actually, you know, our colleague Darren, who would say, you know, she's extremely viable, right? She's very likely to win the nomination if she gets in. Is she electable? That's the question.
Yeah, you know? Well, but I mean, I think they were even saying prohibitive favorite in the primary.
Oh, in the primary.
Just in the primary.
Yeah.
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 I think prohibitive is a strong word, but let's look at the evidence and then we can revisit that.
I think that's what we didn't do yesterday.
We didn't have time for me to whip out numbers. You know, it's not my role.
Right.
So yeah, why don't we go through, and we've done this on the podcast, but give us a quick look at the favorability ratings.
Yeah, so we asked in October of this year about a number of, you know, candidates, including Allred, Tallarico, Terry Virts also, and Crockett, thinking about, you know, people who either had not announced that they're running for that Senate seat or, again, strongly.
Yeah, the trial balloons were already up. Yeah. It was a legit thing to check on her, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, again, yeah, it's possible she could run for, and there's a question coming, she could run for other offices.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. That was an interesting thing you said earlier.
So, you know, when we looked at those numbers, overall, you know, for the Democrats, Colin Allred, who's, again, probably should be one of the more known candidates having run statewide, overall 32 favorable, 32 unfavorable, which honestly looked about where Crockett was. She was at 30 favorable, 32 unfavorable, which is pretty, again, good for someone who's never run statewide by comparison. Representative Tallarico, who has built a very, you know, I think, well-recognized social media operation, was at 22 favorable, 12 unfavorable. So that means two-thirds of voters overall, 65%, didn't know who James Tallarico was, compared to 35% for Allred and 38% for Crockett. But the notable thing for Crockett in that poll that we certainly noticed, and because it was very noticeable, is that among Democrats, she was at 62 favorable, 6 unfavorable, with only a third having no opinion of her. That's slightly better than where Allred was, at 59-10. So he's plus 49, she's plus 56. But this is also notable. I mean, this is sort of to some degree the relative strength of this race. Representative Tallarico was at 43.5. So he was plus 42. So he was just nipping at their heels, at least among Democrats overall.
And again, with a much, much higher level of people saying that they didn't have an opinion.
Right. A majority did not have an opinion about.
Yeah. The people that said they didn't have an opinion, you know, was 31 for Allred, 33 for Crockett. It was 52 for Tallarico.
Right. Which makes sense.
Absolutely.
Right. Now, among strong Democrats, again, you see similar numbers. You know, Allred was at 69.7, Crockett 75. Tallarico at 49.4. But that's the point. I mean, that's the sort of thing. When people are looking at this and saying, well, why do we think, you know, that she's got a strong position? Well, you look at strong Democrats, she looks strong. You look among liberals, Allred's at 69.13, Crockett's at 67.7. So plus 60 among liberals. So when you're thinking about who are the active groups in the Democratic primary, who do they need to persuade? She starts at a very strong position amongst this group of voters.
Right.
And really, straight, honestly, stronger than anyone probably not named like Beto O'Rourke or something like that, at least amongst the most core Democratic voters.
And so, you know, I mean, I you know, to this notion of, you know, this is unfair to now then continue this debate with my panelists without them being here.
No, I can pretend.
They probably won't hear this anyway. Yeah, so fine. Then, you know, but yeah, I mean, it's the nearness, you know, I mean, there's a lot of parity between Allred and Crockett at this moment. Now, Crockett was not in the race yet.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we'll hopefully have, you know, we'll have an opportunity for too much longer to compare them once we know for sure what she's doing. And, you know, you did raise the possibility, and I don't want to put words in your mouth to be thinking this is going to happen. But, you know, she could pull a rabbit out of her hat and say her big announcement is she's running statewide, but not for the Senate. I don't think that's that likely, but, you know, she can be surprising. She's a dynamic candidate?
It's unlikely. I mean, we've talked about before, you know, the nature of campaign finance makes it an automatic challenge to jump from a federal office to a state office or a state office to a federal office without a pretty good runway. Now, look, promises can be made, you know, things can happen that can make something like that work. But it seems unlikely. But I just was sort of, you know, I mean, sort of this assumption all along that she's running for the Senate. So, you know, I was like, yeah, maybe. I mean,
right.
Now, to your question about, you know, her overall, is she the prohibitive favorite? You know, I'll say this. I mean, just looking at these candidates, just sort of just some thoughts, you know.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I wonder about, you know, her support right now is, you know, let's just say how durable it is. Right. I mean, she's somewhat new to the scene. You know, her rise has been, I'll say, meteoric. You can quote me on that. You know, I mean, she's really moved like very quickly up the ranks. And I think, you know, like any politician, you know, when a bunch of people are whispering in your ear, you know, you should run for senator, you should run for president. Usually it's hard for people not to listen to that. I'm not saying that she shouldn't.
Well, she's also made, you know, she's made a point just to, you know, give her her due that, you know, she's been doing a lot of polling, too.
Yeah,
I mean, they're approaching this.
No, I'm not saying that
like
she's
adults.
Not, I'm not saying. Yeah. I'm not saying she's not. I just think that the thing is that right now the question would be, you know, what happens when she gets into a more competitive environment, right? And how does that play out? I mean, the one thing you can say about Allred is, you know, although his numbers are not overwhelming, you know, for someone who's already run statewide, and that's part of it, honestly. But the other side of it is that you could say he's had an entire campaign season to run, to communicate. He's got his lists built out. Like, he knows who he's contacting. Like, there are advantages to that that are you know, not on MSNBC that really do matter in terms of establishing a campaign and going out when you're telling people to vote for you again and that you've already talked to them before, right? And I think, you know, I got to be honest, you know, I'm really interested to see what Tallarico does here, because, I mean, his numbers are pretty darn impressive for a state rep, and that's because he's built a social media operation that's really gotten him out there in a way, you know, among us.
And he's
things.
Made a couple of good decisions that broke his way. The Joe Rogan thing.
Yeah, the Joe Rogan thing totally broke his way.
You know, the emphasis on, you know, his emphasis on his faith and all of this is, you know, was a good, I'm not saying it's not insincere, because obviously I think my judgment is it is.
Yeah.
But it was also, you know, it's a good media play.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, he, you know, I don't think that there's going to be a lot of crossover voters, but he certainly does a lot to paint a different path. Now, is that the path voters want?
And, you know, can, you know, in a statewide, you know, say he got out of the primary, but even in the, you know, his voting record and the issues, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things on the record that he can be painted as out of the mainstream.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not saying he is, but, you know, just in the way of things.
No, but you know, he's been a more, I'll say this, he's been a more active opposition party member than most.
Than a lot, yeah.
Than a lot have.
Yeah,
and right. What that includes is that includes filing bills, which he has done, that, you know, will be used against him if he makes it to the generals, being outside the mainstream, but in an effort to essentially, you know, force silence or, you know, point out when the silence exists on these things. So, I mean, he's got a little bit more of a record floating around out there.
And I think the other thing, you know, but what's interesting about that also, though, if Crockett gets in the race, and again, I should say, I mean, I haven't looked at any prediction markets, but my guess is, you know, would she have a big event on Monday to announce that she's not going to run?
Right.
I mean, it just doesn't seem all that likely, I mean, right?
Yeah.
I think that burns up some of her credibility, frankly, and I don't think she would want to do that.
I agree with you completely.
I think people would not give her advice to do that.
No.
But there's, you know, I mean, before we move on, there's a little bit of a political economy piece to this, too, in which, you know, this is going to put Democratic donors at the primary level in a very interesting position.
Yeah.
Because Jasmine Crockett has shown that she can raise money.
Right.
Right. She's a pretty, you know, there's a thing in either Politico or Punch Bowl a couple of months ago, the last quarterly reports, she'd raised a pretty good bucket of money.
Yeah, she's up
and
there.
Was in kind of, you know,
the
top
list,
tier
yeah.
of, yeah, congressional fundraisers. You know, and is a minority member, you know, but numerical minority member. You know, Tallarico had a good fundraising cycle.
Yep.
Allred has, you know, been considered kind of the establishment.
Right.
You know, he has, he has an ability to raise at least some money. So that piece of this is going to be, I think, very interesting. And, you know, some donors will see this as an opportunity. Many are going to see it as a headache. Right. I mean, I think it was Abby Livingston on a podcast a few days ago. It was either Abby Livingston or Leanne Caldwell. I'm not sure, to be honest, but one of those two smart women saying, you know, there is this kind of fatigue with donors. I think it was Abby, actually, the more I think about it, that, you know, every cycle, people look at Texas and go, there's this person. We really, you know, we can't win. We got to put some money on this to even have a shot.
Right.
Then they put money, they put a bunch of money into it. And then there's a kind of buyer's remorse. And so there's a certain weariness that was being reported among donors going, oh, so we're going to go through this again. Huh? And, you know, look, you go through that until you break through. And I'm not going to feel sorry for donors.
I was going to say.
Yeah, I don't have any sympathy, but I have, you know, I can empathize. I understand the position. Let's put it that way and understand the dynamic and think it makes sense.
Yeah, and the political economy there is interesting because, I mean, until recently, you know, Texas is a donor state. I mean, Texans, Democrats or Republicans were mostly looking to donate out of state to more competitive races. The challenge now is that, you know, there's a limited number of competitive races of which Texas might be one of them if anybody wants to play in the Senate races. So, yeah, they may be fatigued, but ultimately there's not a lot of other places to go spend
their money. I think that, you know, they were talking about kind of the national donor class. And so there is a complicated chessboard out there in terms of where you're going to put money. I mean, I think that was more, I think, from the perspective of, you know, both of the reporters that I'm thinking might have said this are D.C.-based reporters.
Yeah, right? That makes sense. I mean, so, it is interesting. It is one of those things where, you know, Democrats want to talk about a lot about Texas, and they're like, "Ooh, that's a big state."
All right. So elsewhere in Congress.
That's expensive.
Elsewhere in the Texas congressional delegation, State Representative and Longhorn Henry Cuellar.
Right.
I think you have to consider this kind of a surprise development.
Yeah.
Was, you know, promised a pardon by Donald Trump on Truth Social.
Yep.
For, you know, the still pending charges, as I recall it. Bribery charges are still
money
there.
Money laundering, I believe.
And what was the other one?
Money laundering, I
believe. And bribery and money laundering. But I think the core of them were bribery, but I'm not sure. And there had also been some unregistered foreign agent charges that were abandoned by the Justice Department. But the Justice Department had been moving forward with this, and the president has, you know, issued a pardon for him for related to these charges. So, you know, peripheral things, you know, I'd like, you know, the public story was that, you know, Congressman Cuellar's daughters wrote a letter.
I saw that.
You know,
okay.
It had to be kind of more than that. I would like to know what those channels were and who, you know, who was really, you know, discussing this with the president. I mean, because I just don't think it's likely the president was going through his mail or, you know, the assistant comes up and hands him a letter and he's got a Sharpie and goes, oh, yeah, we got to pardon this guy. I, you know, there's more going on here. I don't know what it is.
What you say is interesting because I think this is the point, too. It's like, you know, there's sort of the like, what was, you know, sort of what was Trump's, you know, rationale, reasoning, whatever, besides what he sort of told us publicly. But then there's the other side, which is like, yeah, but like other people had to be involved. And who were they and what was their reasoning? Because it's very complicated. Right? Just to say, like, you know, you could say, well, he's a conservative Democrat. You know, he's got some good ties. So maybe, you know, maybe there was somebody on that side who had a better line to kind of push this sort of deal through. But at the same time, you're like, yeah, but Republicans are targeting Cuellar.
Right.
Like, I mean, they're actively trying to get him out of this Congress.
I mean, that's one of the implications. I was going to get to that. We'll just get to that. Yeah. I mean, look, you know, in this count of, you know, the five seats based on 2024 returns in the new maps that Republicans might gain in the Texas congressional delegation that was motivating to some degree, the redistricting fight we're in the middle of. You know, Cuellar's district was one of those. Now, it was also one of those that people pretty quickly said, yeah, five's a big number.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, whatever. But so, you know, I that's a big piece of this that is kind of one of those curious things that, you know, look, is characteristic of the Trump administration where, you know, the strategy seems to be moving one direction and then the president engages in an act or tactic that seems to not be in line with the, you know, the plan.
Well, I mean, I just like, and I mean, this is the hottest of hot takes, but I just can't see how he's not just so insulated now. I mean, if you think about the fact that the indictment came down like during the campaign last time and they raided his house, still didn't matter, still got reelected. Still got reelected.
Oh, him being Cuellar.
Cuellar. Still got reelected in a district that Trump carried. And now, you know, to the extent that, you know, there's opposition aligning, you know, again, a former Democrat turned Republican who's going to run against him. And now all of a sudden, I mean, I'm not going to, it's not a Trump endorsement, but like, it's
pretty close.
It's pretty close. I mean, and so it's sort of like, I mean, you know, you kind of say to yourself, I mean, like, is this going to turn off a bunch of Democrats from supporting Cuellar? And my answer from, you know, being down here is like, nothing else has.
Yeah.
So why would this? And if anything, it takes one of his biggest liabilities and you have, you know,
he
the
just
chief,
moves it off the table.
Yeah. You take the chief antagonist possible and he said, no, it's not an issue.
Yeah.
So it's really a remarkable.
And look, people are, you know, in that, you know, and is the primary unfolds, people will.
Yeah.
I mean, look, there's a, you know, there's a potential for a counter dynamic here, but it's just, you know, all the you know, informal soundings coming out of that were that he was still in pretty good shape despite all this. And look, I, you know, before we go too far with this, you know, this seems weird. I mean, look, there is a, you know, one could say, come on, guys, there's a clear political logic. He's the most conservative, you know, one of the most conservative Democrats, if not the most, in the U.S. House, certainly, in the, you know, one of the most in the Texas, you know, probably the most in the Texas delegation on the Democratic side. He, you know, he sort of, you know, triangulated pretty effectively with Trump on border matters at the time that border security was front and center. And he's got, you know, deep, deep, deep roots in that district, you know. Yeah. And so, again, we're not missing that here. And you could see where whatever happens in the House, it's probably pretty good for the Trump team to have Henry Cuellar still in the House.
No, I mean, the context that I look at it in, and I have no connection, but it goes back to your whole, you'd like to know more of the story.
Yeah.
To me is to say, yeah, this seems, if you want to say, where does this fit for me? It fits into the ongoing efforts by the Republican Party in the state to court conservative leaning Hispanics of all stripes into the fold.
Right.
And that's, and that, and in particular, and that is the area of the state where they've been working most assiduously and aggressively, including through redistricting, but also just regular on the ground efforts. And, you know, there have been, I mean, we could start listing Democrat turned Republican Hispanic representatives from that region. And look, this may be a long-term play for Cuellar,
including Cuellar's probable opponent.
Right. Including Cuellar's probable opponent. So the reality is, you know, I mean, in some ways, I do see this in the broader context of that, but that raises the question, who put this matter on the radar?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, just to clarify, my question about that is just, you know, there's a lot of chaos.
Yeah.
And he's clearly, you know, people know that, Donald Trump's got this big bucket of pardons and he's just kind of distributing them out there. How does his name get on the list? Who brought it to his attention is my question.
Look, this probably, like, you know, it matters in various ways, and we could talk about some of those. We don't need to. I mean, one of the ways that I think is interesting that I want to look at, kind of just put a pin in for later, right, is, I mean, I think you made a really good connection there, which is Trump has now come, you know, essentially demanded that Republicans of the state come back in to redraw the congressional maps to create these new districts that ultimately has, you know, contributed in small or large part, unknowable, to at least six current incumbent Republicans leaving Congress. Yeah. And at the same time as that's going on, he's taking one of the most embattled Democrats and essentially giving him a pardon, right? And potentially a pardon, you know, in the election in terms of how difficult it's going to be taking this off the table. And so, I mean, in terms of just the overall coalition management, and again, this is why it's, of course, like, where did it come from? But you are sort of left thinking, like, you know, for one of these Republicans who was there all summer, you know, waiting for the Democrats to come back, you know, dealing with all this, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, but we're going to let him off the hook.
I think, and again, I mean, I, you know, just to game out another part of this. Yeah. So, okay, so say Congressman Cuellar wins primary, wins general election, wins primary, he's going to win the general, you know, wins the general election, goes back to Congress, and then you start looking at the different, you know, path dependent, right? So he wins, Democrats retake the House. He's in good shape for his own self-interest, and he's a good asset for the Trump White House. They have at least some kind of conduit, somebody that they're tied to in the Democratic caucus. Mm-hmm. Republicans hang on to the House. Well, then either he stays in the Democratic Party but becomes a pretty powerful conduit in the same way.
Yeah.
or he changes party, which, you know, has been the ongoing,
right,
you know, matter of speculation for several years now, certainly since the border stuff all erupted. So, you know, and I guess what that would mean to connect those two is that, you know, did somebody make that argument to the president? Who was it? That's how those two are connected, I guess, in my head, beyond my, just my native curiosity about, you know, what goes on, what's going on in the White House, you know, what the hell, right? So, you know, we've already kind of hit, you know, in a wider angle, you know, it's another complication in the redistricting saga, right? A very interesting ones, and there's all these kind of, you know, scenarios, but, you know, there is an interesting, you know, intersection to kind of start tying all this stuff together. You know, and we've just kind of done this.
Yeah.
Between something I tried to get the panel to kind of engage with yesterday, and I've now done this twice. I just got to stop doing it with these guys that they just doesn't really take from my moderator hat. But, you know, there is this intersection of where Texas politics on the ground are meeting these nationalizing forces.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's big structural things, but things like this, it's like the meat of the stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
you know, because, you know, Henry Cuellar is a very, in a lot of, I mean, you know, he's not unique in this sense, but it's a very Texas thing because it's about, you know, the history of politics in South Texas. Mm-hmm. It's about Henry Cuellar's long presence there.
Yeah.
It's about this, you know, the effort you were talking about by the Republican Party in South Texas. So it's just, you know, to me, it's just a fascinating case of all that.
Yeah.
And look, we should just, you know, stipulate. I mean, Henry got his PhD here. You know, I've known him for, been acquainted with him, friendly with him for a long time.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, that curiosity there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a thing.
Well, when you say that, you know, and not to get too general, but I mean, it makes me immediately think about the way that Trump's ascendancy has essentially jumbled communications among, you know, Texas Republicans, right? And
so
we talk about this, and the thing that really is the most shocking is the extent to which, you know, immigration and border security has just fallen off the radar of most important problems facing the state among Republicans. And not only did this drive their concern, drive their priorities to the legislature, drive their priorities in campaigns and elections.
It was the identity of the party.
That's the thing. It was the core identity of the party was concern over immigration and unchecked immigration. And now it's just vanished in some sense. And that's being a little facetious, but in a lot of ways, it's almost vanished from the polling in some ways. And on the one hand, you could say, I mean, I think someone could listen to, because Trump has dealt with it. But even if that's the case, there's a vacuum that's been left by that. That's sort of like, but what do they talk about now?
Right.
And I think, you know, to some extent, to the extent that we're seeing, you know, a lot of bombs being thrown in a lot of different directions, I think that's a pure reflection of this nationalization piece, which is, you know, look, they can't go after the Republican administration, like they would a Democratic administration. So they're not looking at the federal government. It's controlled by Republicans. And so you end up with this, we can't talk about the border, you know, anymore.
Yeah.
It's not an issue. And so we're getting these like increasingly narrow and sort of, you know, increasingly divisionary topics.
Well, and I think that, you know, both the nature of the people that are surrounding Trump and have influence in the second term, and the president's own political instincts based on what's worked for him, are leading them to attempt to use immigration enforcement to maintain that juice. But I think, you know, what we're seeing is that, look, you know, and I don't, I was looking at some of the internals in our stuff a couple days ago for, I think, I don't remember why, but, you know, look, the attitudes about immigration are still there.
Yeah, right.
And the issue is not completely disappeared.
No.
Right? There's still about a third of Republicans and don't hold, I think that's about right.
And there are more
that will still say this is the most important issue. And some of the border security concerns
and there are more,
moved into immigration.
And there are more negative underlying attitudes in the electorate as a whole towards immigration writ large. So, I mean, that conversation has definitely shifted in a way. But what's noticeable—
And it doesn't get you the same— It's not getting them the same oomph. And it's not taking up the same cognitive bandwidth and attitudinal bandwidth among Republicans as the joint, you know, there's too many immigrants in the country and the border's a mess. Now that the border's controlled, this other thing they're still trying to, you know, lean on, but.
Well, it's really interesting to me just because I think, you know, you go back a couple of years and you'd see like a week where, you know, Abbott would be doing a press conference outside, you know, an ICE facility for children, basically saying this place is a disaster. And then he's going up to, you know, Dallas talking about crime conducted, you know, committed by undocumented immigrants and sort of like, and it's not even, you know, it's like, and again, the attitudes are still there, but like, it's just, it's all been kind of like, well, we're not going to talk about this now. And that's really changed, like fundamentally, we've been watching this for a long time. Fundamentally, it's really changed the
dynamics.
Yeah, well,
I mean, I guess what I would say to that, I mean, is that they, you know, they're trying to talk about it, right? I mean, look, this, I'm trying to put this in the most diplomatic way possible, but, you know, the tragic shooting in Washington, D.C. of the two National Guardsmen, right? The talking about that was in the administration's comfort zone, and Trump obviously has been leaning into that. The subsequent, you know, comments about Somalis,
right?
You know, the really, I think, reflexive response in terms of, you know, migrants from Afghanistan, and you know, we should note. I mean, this is a really fundamental shift in the attitude towards that particular group of people, that is people that had worked with the U.S. during the long U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Right.
I mean, one of the things that the Biden administration was criticized for, you know, other than, you know, mainly it was the chaos and the bombing, the loss of life and the bombing at the airport and, you know, the Saigon-like images of the transports taking off. But there was also a, hey, you guys are not taking care of the people that supported us. And that was kind of a bipartisan concern.
Yeah.
And, you know, and understandably to some degree, but that, you know, that is no longer an element of certainly the governing coalition within the Republican Party at this moment.
Yeah, just
and that's, again, politically understandable.
But. Yeah, just, and that reminds me of, you know, when we... Back during the first, I want to say during the first campaign, you know, there was the terrorist attack in France. And we wrote a piece on that at the time that in some ways, you know, what that did was it allowed the conversation to shift from focusing on particularly immigration and immigrants from Central and South America who, you know, who's honestly—
To a broader—
To a different group of immigrants, right? And ultimately that was much more comfortable place to be because obviously those immigrants make up a much— smaller share of the electorate overall and a much, you know, smaller share of the overall melting pot, et cetera, et cetera. For the rhetoric to move,
right?
And so you could still talk about immigration because now you're talking about immigration, you're talking about terrorism, right? And that's, you know, that kind of, and that's where I think, and to speak German, that's where Trump is going to be the most comfortable. It's on crime, public safety, the idea of like national security, being tough. And then if we can say, well, no, this is about potential terrorists from these other countries, that's a great shift away from kind of where it is right now, which is this question of like, so are we picking the kids up at the hospitals or at the schools?
It's not, you know, again, that's why I was trying to be sensitive, but it's not surprising that they are leaning
and you're
extremely
right.
hard on this politically. But, you know, I mean, to your, you know, to where we started in this sub point, I mean, at the same time, Trump is now at least twice, President Trump at least twice in the last week or so has said, yeah, this affordability concern is a Democratic invention. It's, you know, essentially it's bullshit.
Right.
Right. If he hasn't used the word bullshit, yes, like it's coming.
Yeah, right.
Right. And I, you know.
That's a loser. I'm just going to say, I mean, you know, that's a loser.
You know, unless, you know, and look, there's a school of thought out there that I, among, you know, some Republican strategists, and I think this came up in the panel at Pat yesterday, that, you know, the expectation in air quotes is that the economy will begin to recover and look better by the summer. I don't see it. I don't see why people, I mean, you know, look, you can bring an economist on or some, you know, that will tell you, look, you know, the inflation, you know, inflation is cooled and the Fed will lower interest rates, but the employment market, you know, will be able to absorb this. And, you know, but it's a pretty, it's kind of a Rube Goldberg contraption of, no, the economy could work again if we just, you know, put a hot dog right here or something. Well, I just don't, it's hard to see.
And again, I think this, you know, that's a, I mean, obviously, there's that out there. But then you also have people who are knowledgeable, both whether politically or economically, thinking about like, well, what if we just wrote everybody a check?
And when you have people
like the conservative lieutenant governor of Texas talking about it, and you've got people like Scott Bessent saying, well, if we do that, we hope that not everybody spends it.
$1,000 for every kid we can find.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, just, but hopefully they save it because we can't, you know, yeah. It's like, I mean, that tells you like, yeah, maybe.
You know, I think we put a pin in that for next week's
we'll come
podcast.
Back to that. Yeah.
I'm even going to kind of write that down. What I'm writing down is statism.
Yeah, great.
But I think
makes it hard to believe that when you see these other kinds of trial balloons being floated.
But it speaks to a deeper dynamic that we've seen, I think, in the Republican Party, obviously the rise of Trump, et cetera. Yeah. And I've been, you know, reading it, I'm only not that far into it because life, but, you know, Furious Minds by Laura Field, who was a grad student here. Right. I started that book, and so far it's quite good and quite useful.
Oh, okay.
Very interesting. So, but it speaks, you know, her thing is kind of parsing out the intersection of different streams of more contemporary conservative thought in the Trump era, and tying it, you know, to shifts in conservatism overall, but with an eye on politics.
It's a Texas,
you know,
PhD.
And again, I'm only, you know, 30, 40 pages in, but it's off to a very good and helpful, useful start. The way she parses out some of this stuff is very interesting. So maybe that'll come up. I don't know how much time I'll have to read more in that book between next week. But yeah, so we'll come back for at least one more podcast this year is the plan. Probably just one more. So I think in our podcast next week, we'll do a little bit of a year-end wrap-up, and maybe we'll get at some of these bigger themes. You know, by then we'll know what Jasmine Crockett has done. Maybe, who knows, we'll have even heard from the Supreme Court, but we'll, you know, definitely have a more full and final view of what the ballots are going to look, what the tickets are going to look like in the primary elections next year. So until then, thanks, Josh, for being here and for the ride again this morning. Thanks to our terrific and excellent production team in the Liberal Arts Development Studio here at UT Austin. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. All this data and more at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And we'll be back next week with another Second Reading podcast. So long. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.